Hi again. Last time we talked about distorted images of God and the way they develop in abusive systems, and the difficulty and the painful reality that represents in our lives when we find that we've served and worshipped and loved gods that are incapable of returning that love and who are not worthy of our worship and service. We will be talking, starting next week, about different strategies for disentangling ourselves from there. But I think before we go there, it's important to talk a bit about an analogous kind of problem, and that is the way our senses of ourselves get distorted in abusive systems. This is the second kind of primary core wound. Not just that we arrive in life at a place where we're full of attachments to gods who are not God, and gods who do not deserve our worship and service, but we also acquire this very painful and disturbing sense of convictions, not quite convictions, but images of ourselves again. Convictions is at the surface of things. These images lie deep within us and are kind of well protected because they're so painful. We don't want to expose those very, very painful parts of us. So that's what we'll be talking about today. In an abusive system, whatever the role is, the primary role to which one's assigned, or however much one moves around between roles, there's going to be a lot of fears about the self and distortions about the self that sort of fill the space in the abusive system. Some of these fears are connected with God, which we talked about last time, the fear that God's punitive and judgmental or distant or harsh or inattentive or what have you. All those sort of fears are part of the puzzle here. But the fears about ourselves are also a very, very prominent part of abusive systems. And let's look again at each of these roles and ask ourselves, what would be common ways for common fears about the self that people might experience? In the case of the person in the victim role, there's this often a very pronounced sense that I'm bad, irreparably bad. This often comes from situations where, well, there was a hint at this in the incest video we watched, where you have this, when you're being abused by someone whom you love, there's a particular kind of unintelligibility to that. I can't be angry at someone that I love. It's very, particularly for a kid, how do you make sense out of that? And so being unable to kind of, put blame appropriately where it belongs and to experience anger that would be appropriate under the circumstances, being not really developmentally able yet to do that, there's nothing left but kind of internalizing that blame and that shame and that sense of worthlessness. It must be about me. It must be about me. I must be really damaged goods because this is how people treat me. So there's this sense of being bad, of being unlovable. If people do unlovable things to me, I must be unlovable. It's not that that's irrational, right? It's not true. But it's not a completely, it's not a process that's taking place at a rational level. We don't conclude, we deduce that we're unlovable. It's just, it kind of, the fear of that fills the space for us. And we kind of are trying to navigate our way through life with this really deep sense that we're guilty or bad, pretty worthless. It's a very painful sense of self. It can persist over long periods of time. It doesn't go away because we argue with it. It takes some other kinds of life experiences to help us have new experiences to process that can challenge these assumptions of self, but they're very deeply rooted assumptions about who we are. Let's look at the non-protective person. The fear that dominates here, I think, is the sense of self as incompetent or unreliable. I think Bev's story in the incest video has an element of this, the sort of painful recognition she had when she knew, when she was able to observe that she had not been able to protect her kids. That sense of, I just can't function, couldn't even do that, is an enormous threat, an enormous fear about one's own, as I'll claim about all of these fears, that it poses a kind of existential threat to us. It's kind of an annihilating fear. It overwhelms us so that we feel almost like our existence is threatened because of this overwhelming fear that we're incompetent, not competent enough to do the most basic of things in life. For someone who is in the abuser role, the fears tend to be that I'm dangerous, or that I'm unable to love others. Now again, as always with people in an abuser role, there's some complications because when you work with the abusers, they may not have any access to their fears at all. This may be so painful and so annihilating that it's completely shut down. Certainly if they're also using medications to keep the lid on the pain of these fears, there may be nobody home to give you information about this. But my experience has been that with the exception of genuinely sociopathic abusers, which is a very small subset of all abusers, the level of fear about the self is staggeringly high. It's not like people abuse others and then feel, well, I got what I wanted. They walk away with this deep sense that I'm dangerous to people I care about. I'm really damaged, and I am what's the matter with me that I'm unable to love other people in ways that help them. That's a fear that's very deep, very painful, and I don't want to get in the business of comparing pains here, but all of these fears are posed enormous threats to the integrity of our sense of self. For the person who's in a hero or messiah role, there's this fear of their sense of self as insecure or anxious. Like, I'm always have to be doing something more, something that haven't really not yet secure in my identity. I have to produce more. I have to get more done. There's a sense that I'm obligated to do everything that needs to be done. And as a consequence, there's what I call the emergence of the not enough self. There's just not enough. There's never enough. And this anxiety about being not enough shows up in all kinds of strange places. I often use the example of the biblical text, all things work together for good to those who love God enough. Now, of course, the word is not in the text, but that is how it's read, how it's experienced by people struggling with this kind of role in abusive systems. They always hear the word enough, and even if it's not there. And it's always this, you should do more, it's not enough. And that's the fear of not being adequate, of not ever being able to get yourself to the place where it's just okay, is an overwhelming fear. And I feel like I've said that a number of times now, that these fears about the self that emerge in abusive systems impact everybody in the system, not just the person who's been abused. Everybody has these staggering level of fears about their identity and their selfhood. And I think what's real is that these fears are so painful and so annihilating to the self that we simply can't live with them. We have to do something with fears that are that big. We have to find a way to negotiate life without staying in conscious contact with these terrors. And what we do is create a whole ring of defenses around the self. So that, and it's a quite a variety of different kinds of defensive structures, or I prefer to call them defensive gestures. They're ways that we protect ourselves from knowing what's really going on and the fears that we're experiencing, because we invest so much in these defenses that we wind up thinking that we are our defenses. And, you know, having these defensive structures distracts us from the fears, because we're putting all our energies into our defensive structures. And it just means that there's less energy and time to spend on the fears, which is, you know, still lying there, festering away inside of us. Just a few things about the kinds of defensive structures that you see quite frequently in people who are living with the kind of fears about the self that develop in abusive systems. I wouldn't link any of these particularly to a particular role, because I think once you're developing defensive gestures, you find yourself, you know, grabbing whatever's available, you know, and you might put two or three of these together. But if we start with the abuser, I think very common strategies there are addictions or compulsions. This is either to medicate ourselves against that fear. Fear can be medicated for short periods of time if you can tolerate the other kinds of harm that gets done by that sort of medication. You know, it's clearly not a way out, but it does give it's either an attempt to anesthetize the fear or an attempt to distract ourselves from the fear. So, and distract everybody else from the fear. Everybody's now concerned about my drinking behavior or my drug use. Instead of having to focus on the fear, I create all this chaos that distracts people's attention from looking at these deep structural issues. For people who lean into the non-protective person role and live with this fear of incompetence and unreliability, how do you manage that kind of fear? Well, there's a number of things. One is that you can withdraw. Now, one of the reasons withdrawal works is you never find yourself in a position where someone's depending on you. You've preemptively withdrawn to a safe place, so no one's saying, well, he's going to take care of it, she's going to take care of it. So there's this sense that I protected myself. If I showed up, if I was really engaged, people might notice how incompetent I am. And that fear goes all the way down to bedrock for me. I don't want that exposed. So I'll just, you know, keep at a distance. Underfunctioning is the same kind of thing. If I underfunction, people will, if I preemptively underfunction, people will not have high expectations of me. And so my fear of being incompetent may never be exposed, because I've never asked to perform at a higher level. Kind of slide through things. Paradoxically, I think you can get just exactly the opposite kind of thing from the experience, the fear of myself as incompetent and unreliable, and that's a kind of self-sufficiency. I don't need anybody else. I'm going to take care of everything. I'm going to be omnicompetent, never needing anybody to help me do anything, because I never want to be in a position where something might happen that reconnects me with that deep fear of being incompetent and unreliable. So I'm going to get everything right. People in the abuser role demonstrate just a wide range of defensive gestures. as a result of experience in abusive systems. There's often a kind of emotional numbness. I've always been amazed how when people first start talking about abusive experiences of various kinds, that it rarely comes out with appropriate affect. It'll come out very flat, and it will, I mean, it's really important for people listening to those stories to make room for that flat affect. It's therefore a reason to protect them. It's a defensive gesture, because there's the fear if I let the affect out, it would be so overwhelming that it would be annihilating to me as a human being. So there's a necessary process. And what you do to be helpful then is to not criticize or urge them to be more affective in the way they talk about things, but to listen to the narrative, acknowledge that it's painful, and you know, keep the process going. Silence, however, is also a very common thing. We're just not going to talk about this. Maybe it'll go away. Maybe you know, time heals all wounds. I can assure you that time doesn't heal any wounds. The wounds just hide within us in some temporary retaining area and fester and get worse over time. Time does not heal wounds. Self-deprecation is one of the defensive gestures that you might see. People always putting themselves down, making negative comments about themselves, as a, again, a kind of preemptive way of saying, well, I already know that about myself. I know how bad and bad I am. This might show up in what might seem fairly innocent ways, preemptive, compulsive apologizing, for example, is one way that you see this. Someone who's just always apologizing, even when there's nothing to apologize for, but there will, it's kind of a default posture in relationships to be apologizing when there's nothing to apologize for. And it's a preemptive attempt to say, you don't have to criticize me, I've already criticized myself. There's a couple of technical words here, dissociation and hypervigilance. Maybe a word's appropriate about those. I suspect most of you have some sensibility about these. Dissociation is a defensive strategy. It means that when I'm dissociated, only part of me shows up. If I sense I'm going into a dangerous situation, I'm going to withhold some of myself and only let part of myself be vulnerable to what's going on here. Example, I experienced a lot of spiritual abuse as a kid. Certain stages of my recovery, I'd go to a new church and I'd sit down, the service would happen. If you asked me later what we sang, what the sermon was about, I couldn't come up with anything. I just sat down, checked out, and was basically dissociative for the entire service. Now, let me emphasize that the capacity to dissociate is a pretty important skill. I mean, it is, under appropriate circumstances, it can be very helpful to people. It can save your life on a battlefield. So when things are genuinely dangerous and you need to protect yourself, dissociation is a helpful strategy. As a kid, the reason I'm very good at dissociation is I learned it as a kid. It kept me safe. It was a very helpful strategy. It got me through a lot of dangerous situations. It's just later in life, you know, when you're not in dangerous situations and you try to use the same strategies, doesn't work so good, doesn't look so good, you know, trying to navigate an intimate relationship when you dissociate at the first sign of a problem is a hindrance to developing intimacy, isn't it? But so dissociation is fundamentally a very important process, an important skill. It's not a negative thing. But dissociating in relatively safe environments can really make a mess of things. The same is true with hypervigilance. Hypervigilance is just paying attention, you know, a very focused kind of paying attention. And there are times in life when it's really important to be able to have hyper focus. It can protect you from danger again. So on the battlefield, where there's danger, hypervigilance is an important skill. But in other situations where the danger is not so great, it can prevent us from engaging in inappropriate ways, because we're just always, you know, we've got our early warning radar systems turned up all the way, and we're watching for the slightest sign of danger. Just to use another recovery from spiritual abuse example, I remember once going to a church. This was a little later in the process of recovery, actually, going to church, sitting through the service, and I wasn't dissociating anymore, but the pastor used the wrong word. Seriously, it was just, he used the wrong word. He had no way of knowing it was the wrong word. I don't even remember what the word was, but it was clearly a trigger word for me. And, you know, I was being very hyper-vigilant about any danger, and that was a sign of danger. So, you know, what happened then is the hypervigilance activated the dissociative strategy, and also I shut down right away. Well, that kind of thing, you know, seeing danger where there's no danger is one of the problems with defensive strategies in life, and we'll talk more about that later. The defensive gestures that are more typical of people who have experienced the hero or messiah roles, who are anxious about themselves, obligated, you know, the not enough self, tend to be over-functioning rather than under-functioning. I'm just going to be omnicompetent. I'm going to do things right. I'm going to get, you know, good grades in grade school and high school and undergraduate and graduate school. And I'm going to be often very perfectionistic about things. You know, I'm not going to want to be in situations where anybody can say, you didn't do enough. So I'm always defending against the criticism, you didn't do enough. So I'm going to do more than is required. The sorts of things that terrify people using perfectionism as a defensive strategy are failure, you know, because it's not just, for example, maybe this isn't a trivial example to you. Suppose you get a bad grade, or a grade that you perceive as bad. Now, perfectionists have a very different sense of perceptions about what constitutes a bad grade than people who are not into perfectionist driving. But the way it's experienced by perfectionists when they're using this as a defensive gesture is that it's this sort of global catastrophe. It is a kind of existential threat. It is annihilating to have not done good enough. And the a process by which we sort of, I mean, I identify with this a lot myself. I don't want to project too much of my own issues into process in this class, but I suspect a lot of you struggle with this as well. The process of recovery from that perfectionism often involves various kinds of failure, and having to decide eventually that it's really okay to be mortal. It's okay to be a creature. It's okay to be not enough sometimes, because what's really important is not me. What's really important is God, and God has His own plans for things. He's got a long history of working with not enough people. You know, God has not has a long history of taking broken, damaged, hurting, struggling, missing the mark people like us and using them to build His kingdom. And so we don't have to love God enough. You know, we just don't. I know saying that doesn't make it change any. That's still the dynamic. Okay, so deep down, you know, our core, if we've been part of abusive systems, is all the dynamics of abuse, these very painful roles, and around that develop these really very painful perceptions about the self. Again, not quite perceptions, but images of ourselves that are painful to, too painful to stay in connection with, so we surround that with a variety of defensive strategies, defensive gestures that protect us from feeling on a day-to-day basis all those fears and distortions about who, about ourselves. Now, what kinds of things might help someone stuck in this? I'm just going to hint at that today. We're going to, in the next segment, look very specifically at different kinds of strategies that might help us when we're stuck in this kind of situation. But let me just suggest three things that I think are helpful. The first thing that helps is speaking the truth in love. That's, Ephesians 4. It's a text that I have heard abused a lot. And I think in the part of the Christian tradition that I was have spent most of my life in, it often is read as speak the truth, but only so much as to not make anybody upset. That's so the in love part is a kind of constraint on how much truth gets spoken, which in practice means not telling the truth, really. That's what that means. And I don't think that's what the text is about at all. What speaking the truth in love means is find some way to sink your roots so deeply in the soil of God's love that when you speak the truth, it comes out of that secure sense of self as embraced by God, as loved by God, as precious to God. Speak the truth from a stable, protected place. That kind of truth-telling has a capacity to break through, not quite the metaphor I want, but, to be heard past both my own defenses and other people's defenses. It can get down to the fear, and it can even be there without being annihilated, because it's got that love part down. And love makes us strong, makes us stable, makes us able to tolerate fears and anxieties about ourselves. We need someone who can tell the truth and has themselves coming deeply rooted in love, because if they tell the truth and they're deeply rooted in shame, they're going to come and do harm, right? The last thing we need is someone to sort of blunder past our defenses and start, doing shaming truth-telling. It really has to be someone who's deeply rooted in love, who can break through our defenses, be down with us in those fears, so that they can be acknowledged, they can be, seen for what they are, and the power of God can be invited into that very dark and terrifying place for us. So, speaking of truth and love, I mean, it's kind of a general observation, but I think there's something really worth thinking about there, that. There is a way to speak past the defenses and down to the fears, and beyond the fears even to the self that's so entangled in the abusive system that they can't find a better way to be in the world. We need people who can come all the way through the defenses and the fears and hug us down at the depths of our being. That's our calling. That's the essence in my mind of the pastoral calling. Can you see past the defensive gestures of this person? Can you see past all those fears and defenses and see not the abuse that they've experienced, but the precious child of God that is here, the person who's loved and capable of loving others? Can you speak truth there with all the love that would be necessary to empower you to break through all these defensive layers? Okay, I feel like I'm getting a little sermonic now, so historically that's always been a danger. I'm just going to let it be. Second thing that might be helpful has to do with grief work. When we get in touch with all the defensive strategies we use, there's a lot of grief about that because it's hurt us, it's hurt, they've hurt other people, we haven't been available when we needed to be available, things like that. And when we get in touch with the fears and the distortions about ourselves, there's a lot of grief about that. The amount of energy consumed by trying to juggle all those fears. And then when you get all the way down to the abusive dynamics, there is this enormous grief that this could have happened. And, you know, it's understandable that we might protect ourselves from that kind of grief work. None of us will do that kind of grief work unless we feel that we have the level of support we need to do that. I'm not going to grieve those deep losses until I have a sense that there are people who can speak the truth in love, until I have a sense that there are people who can comfort me and care for me in appropriate ways while I'm working my way through the grief process. If all I've got in my life is people who about my grief say, "Why are you still struggling with that?" I'm not going to go there, and neither is anybody else, right? If people communicate it's not okay to be struggling with this, I'm not going to go there, and neither is anybody else. Third thing, before leaving grief, remind you of the particular blessing Jesus promised to people who mourn. And ask yourself, what does that blessing look like? Part of the blessing seems to me to be that since we don't do the grief until we have the support, when we start doing the grief, we experience the support as an enormous blessing. And so that grief and the hard work of grief also comes with an increased capacity for gratitude. We're grateful for the people who could, without shame and deeply rooted in love, could speak the truth to us. And we're grateful for the people who, without shame and without trying to get us to finish this quickly, are able to be with us in our grief. So even as the grief proceeds, we find this a growing capacity in us for gratitude. I'm not quite sure there's any way to develop the capacity for gratitude without deeply engaging in the processes of grief, at least not for people who have had deep experiences with the abusive process. Okay, third thing that helps has to do with developing conscious contact with God. The expression conscious contact is a reflection of my experience in 12-step culture, where this phrase is too commonplace. It's a key expression from one of the 12 steps. And to me, it has to do with this sensibility of being in relationship, not with an idea about God or a set of convictions about God, but to have a life where we have conscious contact with God. That is, we await guidance and we receive guidance. And that sort of experience of divine guidance is often one of the things that is, helps us do some of the work that needs to be done, because it's part of what communicates to us that God has not forgotten who we are. I think that's the point I really want to make here, is that we, because of abuse, we forget who we are. But God has not forgotten who we are. You know, the prodigal son goes to far country, spends his money on cocaine and prostitutes, just guessing. He comes back and he's lost all sense of who he is. The most he can hope for is to be servant, but the father has not forgotten who he is. He is the precious one, the loved one. And so the father does all these confusing things, the party and the ring and the robe, and the son's at this party really profoundly disoriented about, you know, I figured out who I was. I was going to be a servant, and that's not working out. Well, that's not, there's some good analogies there to what it's like to recover from abuse. We figure out in an abusive environment what we're like. We're not worth very much, only to serve others. And then we're at a party given in our honor because God has not forgotten who we are and how precious we are. And we find ourselves very confused initially. How do you be at a party in your honor when your sense of self has been shaped by experiences in abusive systems? It doesn't feel like anything should be in your honor. It feels like you don't deserve that, it's not appropriate, it's like dangerous territory. Is this going to go to your head? You know, all those kind of weird considerations we do. And so my suspicion is, I mean, this is not in the text, my suspicion is that the prodigal takes quite a while to figure out that it's okay to be the precious son of his father, that that's enough, and that he's loved and capable of loving others. Ray Anderson, who some of you may know, although he passed away a few years ago, but he taught theology here at Fuller. And, one of the things he used to say about the prodigal at the party was that the prodigal's conversion doesn't begin when he's in far country and comes to his senses, whatever that means. And it doesn't really begin at the party. It begins when he leaves the party and goes back to far country and starts to tell people there, I was completely wrong about my father, and I was completely wrong about me. I thought I was a worthless piece of nothing, and I thought that's what my father thought of me as well. And I was wrong. I slandered my dad, and I'm back here to tell you, it's a better deal than that. There's a lot of good news. Once you head home, there's a lot of good news there. It takes you a while to get used to it, but there's a lot of good news. What happens when people who have their roots deeply embedded in love can speak truthfully to us, when we find the support that allows us to grieve, and when we have experiences of various kinds that are part of God staying in conscious contact with the Father who knows us better than we know ourselves, who has not ever bought into our defensive gestures, has seen past our fears and knows who we really are. What happens is eventually the defensive gestures moderate. They don't go away all at once, because we may have been practicing that for many years, and they don't just simply disappear because we decide it was a bad idea. That's still lots of instincts around defending ourselves. But gradually the boundary there becomes more porous. And as it does so, we're able to take in more truth and more love, we're able to grieve more and be more grateful, and able to experience God's presence with us more. And the same with our fears that prevented us from putting ourselves in positions where we were vulnerable, moderate, and the barrier that they represent becomes more porous. And eventually you find, down at the heart of things, the last place you ever expect to find the precious peace, there in the midst of things, is you. The self is loved and capable of loving just the way God made you to be. It's still there. And, you know, it may be beat up, it may be surrounded by all these fears and defensive gestures, but God hasn't lost sight of that. God knows where the prize is. It's down there underneath everything. There is who we really are. I love the way Thomas Merton talks about this. Let me just read you in closing a quote from Thomas Merton. We must cast off our false exterior self like the cheap and showy garment that it is. We must find our real self in its very great and very simple dignity, created to be a child of God, capable of loving, with something of God's own sincerity. That, I think, is as simple and clear a statement about the process of recovery as I can think of. It is the gradual process by which God God's agents break through our defenses, past our fears, with gentleness and comfort, and helps us look through the mess that abuse has created in our lives. And there, down at the heart of things, the last thing you ever expected to find there, your precious self, a child of a God who loves you beyond speech. I feel like praying again. I'm just learning to trust that. I know you probably expect Fuller professors to trust that, but I'm still learning how to trust that. So I'm going to trust that today and pray. Father, thank you for not taking our defenses as seriously as we do. Thank you for knowing that hidden under the defenses and under the fears and under all the chaos of the abuse, that there we are, your precious children. Thank you for remembering what's so hard for us to remember. Thank you for making it possible for love, and truth and grief and comfort and your presence to make its way down there. May it be so for us this week. We ask it in Jesus' name. Amen. Thanks for coming. Keep coming back. It works. I'll see you in the forum. Bye-bye.